Dave's Psych Lectures, part of the Thunderbird 6 podcasting network.
All right. So, today we're talking about, we might get this done today, it might take a day and a half. Repeated measures, designs, we've done the sort of standard factorial analysis variance, and now the rest of the course up until the last maybe week of March, maybe even early April, we're just going to talk about different twists on analysis variance. So today we're talking about repeated measures, designs. Okay, say you're interested in something like learning or forget, right? Which is a pretty common thing you're interested in psychology. You can't really study with independent groups. Because if you want to look at how behavior changes over time, by definition, you have to look at the same people as things change over time. Right? So what you have to do is test the same people over and over again. So they're no longer independent groups. Everything we've had so far has been different groups in each cell, right? Even in the one-way analysis of variance was the same, it was different people in like different levels of the independent variable. We talked about factorial designs, we talked about different people in each, like A1, B1, A2, B2, whatever. It was different people. Here we're talking about testing the same people over and over again. So what you're looking at is change over time. It's not the only time you use repeated measures design, but it's a pretty obvious candidate. So what you get is something that looks like this. Let's say this is a retention interval for meant for a list of words, 5 minutes, 1 hour, 24 hours of retention intervals, and then you get three groups of the same group of people tested three times because you want to see how their forgetting happens. Understand what I'm saying? So now could you use independent groups here? A group at 5 minutes, a group at 1 hour, a group at 24 hours? You could. But then you're not going to be able to plot a real forgetting curve for each person. And you can actually do that with this kind of setup. So I think it makes a lot more sense. So the same thing, 5 minutes, 1 hour, 24 hours. Now, there's potentially a problem. I've been harping on observations must be independent, how we can never violate the independence of observations. Right? You just can't. Right? I keep saying, if you know this person's score, it doesn't help me know somebody else's score. Right? So if I know Adam's score, I don't know Ashley's score. They're independent events, independent observations. However, if I'm testing Adam a bunch of times over and over again, by definition, if I know his score at 5 minutes, I'm going to get some idea of his score at 1 hour, because it's still Adam. Right? So the observations now aren't independent anymore. Okay, you see why that's potentially an issue. Does that make sense? Because I keep saying independent observations are very important. And now they aren't independent. In fact, they're completely dependent. Right? Because it's the same person tested more than once. Well, why don't we just throw that in the model? Right? This is the beauty of that whole structural model thing. All we have to do is put this new source of variation in the model, and then we can deal with it. So that's, of course, what we're going to do. So our model looks like this now. X equals mu plus tau plus pi plus epsilon. Pi is like for people. I don't know if it actually is, but that's how I remember it. So any score equals the grand mean plus a treatment effect. And so far, this should remind you a great deal of the standard analysis variance, the one-way simple ANOVA, plus error. In fact, if we ignored this, right, we get mu equals tau plus epsilon. That's what we had for the simple one-way analysis variance that we talked about a couple weeks ago. And this is the effect of subjects. We're actually going to consider subjects, and I'm going to call them subjects. The APA can come and sue me. I'm going to call them subjects. We're going to consider the effect of subjects as another variable. Okay? So there's going to be different levels of subject. So if we just consider another variable, we got the levels Adam, Lisa, Ashley, and whomever. Okay? Make sense? You see what we're doing here now? We're actually going to think of this like it's just another independent variable. And we're going to call that variable subject. Make sense? Okay. So your design now looks like this. See, what I've done here now is I've got this variable called subjects over here. So 5 minutes, 1 hour, 24 hours for a memory test of some sort. Subjects 1, 2, 3, and 4. What we've done here is we've actually decreased epsilon. Think about the standard model for a one-way analysis of variance. Right? X equals U plus tau plus epsilon. And our new model is X equals mu plus tau plus pi plus epsilon. Well, look. These are both still here. These are both still here. Where does the pi come from? Well, from the oven, of course. No, where does the pi come from? It can only come from one place. It has to come from here. It has to come from epsilon, doesn't it? There's nowhere else it could come from. Because we still have tau, we still have mu. So that means we've made epsilon smaller. And making epsilon smaller, good. Because that means the bottom part of our fraction of our F test is going to be smaller if the bottom or the denominator. Numerator and denominator. Is that right?
Denominator
is 12.
Denominator
and numerator? No. Numerator and denominator. Yes, I was right. The bottom, the denominator. Yeah, the denomination. Does that make sense? Of the fraction is smaller. If that happens, what happens? And the top part is going to stay the same size. What happens? It gets bigger. If that number gets bigger, it's easier to find significance. Because the bigger the F value, the more likely it is to exceed some critical value. So we've done something good here. We've made our error smaller. However, remember how I'm always saying, now we partition the sums of squares and degrees of freedom? There's a reason I've been doing this. And I say, don't worry too much about it. But I always show you to split them off. If we split off part of our error, we have to take some degrees of freedom with it. Okay? So the fact that we turned epsilon into pi plus epsilon means epsilon's now going to have fewer degrees of freedom because some of those degrees of freedom left with pi. So now suddenly, while our final F value is going to be bigger, our degrees of freedom are smaller, and if you look at an F table, any time you get fewer degrees of freedom, the critical value increases. The value you have to exceed to find significance increases. Okay? So basically, we've decreased epsilon, but we paid for it. There is no free lunch in statistics. We paid for it in a loss of degrees of freedom, which is almost always worth it, by the way. And I'll show you this in a second. Sort of follow what I'm saying, though, because if we split something off, if we split the source of variation off, some degrees of freedom go with it, they have to. Because to calculate it, we have to do another variance, another set of sums of squares, and that means we've some degrees of freedom go with it. Okay. Well, look at it this way. This is the model would look like this, not the model, but this isn't really a complete analysis or a summary table. It's just source of variation, degrees of freedom. So let's say we were doing this as a regular one-way ANOVA, right? We could actually analyze it that way. We'd be missing out on something, but we could analyze it that way. Right? Because we had 12 subjects. Well, sorry, 12 cells. We really only had 4 subjects. And we have 3 groups. That would be K minus 1 for attention interval, and 2 degrees of freedom. Total of big N minus 1, that's 11. And big N minus K, 12 minus 3 is 9. That's what it would look like for doing the analysis of this rather lame experiment that would never get published because it's showing retention interval increases the likelihood of people forgetting things that Ebbinghaus found in 1890. However, if we put subjects in as a factor, as a variable, we now have 2 degrees of freedom still for retention interval. Just like I said, the treatment effect stays the same. The total stays the same. Any design has a finite amount of degrees of freedom and variation. Subjects, we have 4 subjects, right? S1, S2, S3, S4. 4 minus 1, that would be 3. So we have 3 degrees of freedom for subjects. And what do we have left over? Well, let's see, we've got to get to 11. 2 and 3 is 5. 5 plus 1 is 11 again. Oh, 6. So now our error term now has 6 degrees of freedom. So you see what's happened here? We've made this value smaller. If we had a mean square here, the number itself is going to be smaller. However, this is also smaller. And take a look at any, like I said, you take a look at any statistical table, when the degrees of freedom drop, you do have a small, you will have a loss in power because it's harder to exceed that value. The nice thing is that loss in degrees of freedom made up for by the fact that we've made errors quite a bit smaller? Yeah, it almost always will. So technically, the downside of this kind of design is you pay for the decrease in error with loss of degrees of freedom. That's going to make the final value bigger, giving us more power, but it's also going to make the critical value a bit bigger, affecting, making up for the fact, or pulling down, is maybe a better way to put it, the increase in power. It's going to be worth it, though. So you see what's happened here? Okay. So any design has a finite amount of variance, or variation, and a finite number of degrees of freedom. We've partitioned degrees of freedom and variation just a little further. That's all we've done by throwing in subjects as a variable in a repeated measures design. Mean squared for retention interval will be the same for both analyses. And in fact, the assignment is due on the 17th of March, which the link is now fixed for. I fixed it yesterday during the student town hall meeting about the block plan. Well, I was up there answering questions, but while I'm doing that, I go to the web page. So, it's fixed, and there's actually a question like this. It's a numerical example. It's not really very hard. And it'll show you that the mean squared for the main effect for the treatment, in this case retention interval, is going to be exactly the same for both analyses. The reduction in mean squared, is the reduction in mean squared error worth the loss of degrees of freedom for error? I've said this now 60 or 70 times. Now it's also written down. And it's almost always yes. It's theoretically possible for it to be no, but practically it's almost always the case that this helps. The only time it wouldn't help would be if everyone was exactly the same. And that doesn't happen very often. Because then there'd be no variation accounted for by subjects, right? If everybody's the same, there'd be no variation accounted for by subjects. But frankly, when does that happen? Pretty rarely. You have to have some very basic phenomenon. Exceedingly basic. And I can't even imagine what that would be. This would be in something like physics. This wouldn't even be in because even everybody's biochemistry is a little bit different. Some of those metabolisms are faster. You might think, we can do something with blood pressure or cholesterol. No, it probably still wouldn't work because there's so many other factors that would work. Okay? It certainly wouldn't be the case with a memory experiment like I'm talking about here. So let's think about this for a second. Any questions up to this point? Before I want you to think some more. You said there'd be no thinking. No, that's 21-26.
Memorize the following formulas and learn to do them like a robot.
Was anybody else in this 21-26, the person that went evil? Why? I mean, I know you were. We were saying, wait till 3256, wait till 3256, I'll tell you later. I was doing that constantly. What are degrees of freedom? Beyond the scope of this course, Dave, wait for 381. So I just thought it's different numbers of Western system. Nobody else? Just okay. Weird. Okay. Is it realistic to think, in fact, that this is a sensible model? X equals mu plus tau plus pi plus epsilon. Is that reasonable? And what I'm asking you here is, don't you think that tau should interact with pi?
You're saying, well, I'm sorry, you lost me.
Well, no. Think about this. All that means is that the treatment effect has different effects on different people. It affects some people more than others. So let's say we're doing this experiment and we've got Adam, who's got a really good memory. So the effective retention interval doesn't affect him much. And I'm old. So the effective retention interval on me is quite high. So after 1 hour, I'm screwed. So 5 minutes, I'm fine. I'm just Sims Adam. You know, I can kick it old school with the kids on the street. I don't know what that means. Get the 1 hour and I'm this decrepit old man. I'm 45. Get off my lawn. This chair's going to have to go too. So it actually, that's an interaction. That's the effect of retention. It will change depending upon the person. Right? So isn't it sensible, in fact, to say we should have a tau pi interaction? You ever had that tau pie? It's really good. It's got like a meringue. Okay, enough pie jokes. No, I don't. Okay. So does that make sense? We really should have an interaction. And the model is being unrealistic. And while the models are always a little bit unrealistic, that's a pretty big assumption to say there's no interaction. So our model now should, I mean, it really makes much more sense to assume that there is an interaction between tau and pi. So now our model is going to change a little bit. Okay? The funny thing is the analysis itself, how you do it, doesn't change at all, but the model changes. So now our model looks like this. X equals mu plus tau plus pi plus tau pi. Sounds like we're in some sort of fraternity. Never was a fan of the fraternity. I'll pay for friends.
No. Didn't occur to me again. I'm going to be good.
Tau plus. X equals mu plus tau plus tau pi. Where'd epsilon go? There's no error! Yep, there's no epsilon. Why, you're crazy, Brodbeck. You're out of control.
Out of control.
Let's all get this. Sorry, I just had a little. I just went away to that being at a U2 concert. I'm back now.
Are you missing a pie in there?
No. Yes. Yes, I believe I am. Yes, I am. Yeah, because it was there before, yeah. What am I thinking? Yeah. I tried to slip that one by you, didn't I?
Yeah.
It should be pi there too, sorry. X equals mu, we're done. Any score is the grand mean, we're finished. We're just X. Any score. Thank you guys have been great. We've exhausted the degrees of freedom. What we're doing is we're treating S as just any other variable. So what we've done now is we've literally exhausted the degrees of freedom. If we think of this, we get, in the design we had, This is why, in fact, remember before we called this error, now we're calling it retention rule by subjects. They're actually calculated in exactly the same way, which is kind of a strange thing. But theoretically, the reason I'm doing this, you'll see the set. It just makes more sense to think of it this way. But we end up with retention rule has three levels. Remember, 5 minutes, 1 hour, 24 hours, it's about 2 degrees of freedom. Subjects has four levels. Subjects 1, 2, 3, and 4. So n minus 1, it's got 3 degrees of freedom. The interaction of retention interval by subject is going to have 3 minus 1 times 4 minus 1 degrees of freedom. It's just an interaction. That's going to have then 6 degrees of freedom. The design itself has 11 degrees of freedom. 12 observations minus 1. 2 and 3 is 5, and 6 is 11. There's no room for error.
Whoa, there's no room for error.
You're living on the edge.
So if we could put in a thing called error, I guess we would, but there isn't any. There's no degrees of freedom for it. You can't put something in with 0 degrees of freedom. We've exhausted degrees of freedom. We've explained all variance without saying we have an epsilon term, an error thing. I'm hearing too much of this lecture. I love the lecture just in that. I don't know what's going on. All right. Is this still making sense? Okay. You're a good group. Well, how does this work? Well, our error term is actually a treatment by subject interaction. Because all we say is, wait, are you divide by mean squared error? Except we don't have mean squared error. And we're not just stopping. We don't just stand there and go, I don't know what you do. We actually have an error term, but it's a treatment by subject interaction. So subject, remember that whole random model, mixed model, fixed factor? Yeah, there's a reason I did it. Because we're now going to treat subjects as a random factor. And we're going to treat this like it's a mixed model. Because in essence, that's what it is. We have a fixed factor, which is retention interval, and a random factor, which is subjects. Okay? We actually don't test the subject factor. The only thing that has an error term where we can divide one by the other and isolate the effect, in this case of tau, is the treatment factor. We don't have an error term for the subject factor. There's no mean square with the expected value that will allow us to remove the effect of to just get tau.
Do I have the expected values up here or not?
Okay. Because the expected value for, we've got the effect for treatment and subjects, and mean square for treatment by subjects. And that's going to be the interaction. And that's going to be that plus that. And that's going to just be this. That's the expected values, these mean squares. So you can see what we're going to do. We're going to take mean square treatment, which is the expected value is tau plus tau pi. We're going to divide by mean squared, treated by subject, which is tau pi. Do you see anything here that just has pi on its own? No. So we have no expected value, but we have no mean square with the requisite expected value to test the subject effect. So we can't. Right? We can't. There's no way that has that just the term pi in it. There isn't one. So we can't actually test it. Because this is a mixed model. We can't test the mean square for subjects. We have no way to test it. We have no way to find out if subjects are significantly different from each other. There's no error term with the correct expected mean square. Who cares, though? Oh, what a big piece of data that would be. What a finding. People are different. Right, so even if we could test it, it wouldn't be interesting. A, we can't, and B, who gives a crap?
Oh, I found out that people are different from each other. Give me a Nobel Prize.
You know, come on. So, first of all, it's statistically impossible, and secondly, it's practically stupid. Why would you want to test this? It's something we know. I mean, unless you're dealing with psychophysics.
I believe it's an old song by the Talking Heads.
No, that's Psycho Killer.
I also mentioned stop making sense. Am I still making sense? Stop making sense. A lot of Talking Heads references today. They're apparently just for me.
We can't, and we don't care.
Right.
That's good. Okay. Questions about that? Does that make sense what we're doing there? The reason why we're using the interaction of tau by pi as an error term is because we can. It's the only way to make it work. And in fact, typically what you're going to do as time goes on is you're going to find out what the error term is by looking at, saying, okay, which one has the variable I'm interested in and subjects in it. Okay. You sure you're okay? I mean, I'm happy you're okay, but are you sure? Okay. Either I'm getting better at this,
or everybody's getting smarter every year.
Let's say it's both. It took me 2 days to teach Keel and Boise in Newfoundland, but of course, you know, it's Keel. Okay. Do you remember the match pairs or correlated t-tests or whatever, where we measure two subjects and put them up as a pair and sort of just look at their differences? You know, d bar over s sub d divided by a squared n, right? The old match pairs t-test. So it's this idea where we have subjects, we match them on some variable, and we treat them as an individual, we treat the differences as an individual score. Subjects usually match on an independent variable. I mean, that's typically what you do. So let's say it's very often physiological things, so let's say it's heart rate or some such thing. So you say, I can consider these two the same subject because their heart rates are exactly the same, and then we'll give one group, a cholesterol-releasing drug, and get a person a placebo, but we can consider them basically the same subject for the purposes of our analysis. So by extension, you could do this with analysis invariance. So you could do this with the repeated measures ANOVA, and we're going to do it just basically the same way. Okay? What we need here is something called homogeneity of experimental units. In other words, we have to make sure that we've matched the subjects properly, that they're homogeneous. Okay?
My student once was a gay guy. He said, when I mentioned homogeneous, he said, well, that's me, I'm a homogeneous. That's pretty funny.
He probably is a genius, too. A great guy.
Okay, how are we going to achieve this homogeneity experimental units? There's a few ways we can measure in advance. We could use, like, litter mates. Like, let's say we got rats or something. Rats are all born in litters, so you might end up with, say, three or four at a time. We can assume that, they're pretty similar. They've got the same in utero environment and very similar genomes, right? Fair enough. We can use twins or triplets. Or that octomom, we can use her. Find another set of octuplets for another group. We could use like Charlie Sheen and Emilio Estevez. I feel bad for Emilio Estevez, don't you? He's the nice guy. He's not the guy that dates porn stars, shoots his girlfriend, things like that, goes crazy on TV. But no one knows who he is anymore. He's the nice Sheen boy.
He's the money duck.
He's the money duck guy, yeah. He kept his birth name, he didn't change it to Sheen because, you know, his dad's Martin Sheen. I feel really bad for Emilio Estevez. I don't know. I shouldn't, because I'm sure he's wealthy beyond anything I could ever dream of, just from those stupid Mighty Ducks movies. And being in Breakfast Club. Yeah. Quintessential John Hughes film. Anyway. So what we're going to do is we're going to do something called blocking. This isn't like Kamen blocking and learning. It's much easier. There's no use of the Swartz-Wagner model required. So this variable, the one we block on, so the one we, like, you know, I don't know, we call it a nuisance variable because it's something we can certainly measure, but it's going to get in the way. And we're going to get blocks of subjects that have the same level of that nuisance variable. Okay? You know, if you thought about something like language learning, okay? If you thought about something like language learning, and let's say, oh, here we go. Let's say we wanted to compare the system to go use something as fresh as today's headlines. We're going to use either an immersion-type system of language learning, or we're going to use the standard system that we use now, which is the, meet three times or twice a week for an hour and a half, or we use like a block plan delivery system. There you go. Beautiful. And so it's a free level. And we go, oh, wait a second. Language learning, sometimes some people know more, say, French than other people. Right? Some people didn't put the French immersion, and some people are francophones, and some people are anglophones that sat French class the whole time going, so, which I think by the looks of your face describes the vast majority of the room. So, we would know, in fact, if that would affect how we do in a class. Right? Because if you're bilingual, it really doesn't matter what language learning type you have, because you already speak French. And if you're someone who is in immersion, it's conceivable that something like an immersive type experience, where the class is all done in French and everything's all French, and you know the prof just speaks French, that kind of thing. Okay? The way it tends to be done, and then students, my wife who teaches French, since, you know, the first day when people come into her first year French class, and she's speaking French to them, and about two-thirds of them, I don't know what she's saying. And then, we might have people that have no French at all, and who knows what would happen with them in the different systems. But we would like to be able to say we want an equal number of those type of people, each of those types, in the different groups. We would think of language experience as being a nuisance variable. It's going to get in the way. The beautiful thing is if we get homogeneous blocks of units are subjects in this case, people. If we get homogeneous blocks of units, we can just put one block and say one person here, one person here, one person here. Next block, one person here, one person here, one person here. Right? We can do this. And then we can actually measure the nuisance variable and just check it out. I was an impression of a friend of mine that, you know, it would take me so long to explain to who he was. But I knew a really good impression of him. He talks just like this. You can't get that. It just sounds like somebody you know.
Sounds like my neighbor is Sean Connery.
Oh, no, Sean Connery is more like this.
Shall we call this variable the one we block on a nuisance variable, Axel? There are books in the library. Spiritually dangerous books. I need access to the library!
Name of the Rose. You seen The Name of the Rose?
I love that movie.
The first day Ken Herndon was working here, the university librarian. You know Ken, the guy with the degree in putting books on shelves? He's my best friend, I'm having fun. I stormed into his office. I said, I need access to the library! And he said, there are spiritually dangerous books in here, Axel. Got it right away. One of the many reasons we hang out, because we're both geeks.
Where the hell was I?
Right. This reduces epsilon, which gives us greater power. Go to 110% on the reactor.
That's over October.
See, we're doing the same thing as we did with... If you think of individuals being tested over and over, that's the ultimate homogeneity of experimental unity. Right? I got May, level May, and level May, and level May of the variable subject. That's a pretty homogeneous unit of block subject things.
Well played. Very well said, Dr. Broadbeck. You're nothing if not articulate.
But we typically, maybe we can't do that in this case, but if we got people that have all the same, like, don't know any French really, people that have been, say, taken some French, but all definitely the same level, people that have done French immersion all the way up to grade 12, and people that are literally bilingual,
we can consider them pretty much the same, and that's a block. And that's now, again, going to just reduce epsilon.
The structural model actually is pretty much the same as we had before. So the structural model actually looks like this. X equals mu plus tau plus pi plus epsilon. This isn't the one with tau pi in it. That only really works for the special case where we have the same individuals. Okay? Because we can clearly say that's going to work there.
We can't really do that because the people actually are different, even though we have homogeneity of experimental units. Okay?
So A score equals a grand mean plus a treatment effect plus the block effect plus residual. Okay? Residual is just another word for error. It's leftovers.
Who teaches the history course when you watch Name of the Rose?
She
would. Okay. Mm-hmm. Nice. Do you watch a lot of movies in that class? Or? What else have you seen?
I can't recall off the top of my head.
No?
We watched just a lot of like documentaries.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. So it's not all just fun movies.
Yeah. We watched the one on the Salem Witch Trials.
Yeah.
We spent a whole class time with South Park once.
Yeah, we watched South Park in the last class, actually.
Okay. I got the problem. I was thinking if that whole block plan thing goes through in the memory class, like on the second day, we're just going to watch Memento. Because it's perfect. It's a perfect treatment of intrabrain amnesia. It's beautiful. Mm-hmm. I can't really do it with the system we have now because we have two classes and screw everything up. But I wouldn't do that if we went that other way. All right. I'm not paying this fine, Trebek. It's unjust. You can see when they have the... Celebrity Jeopardy with the guy playing. Oh. SNL. So here are the assumptions about this model. It's not surprising, these assumptions are not scary, they're the same ones you're used to. The sum of the taus equals zero. In other words, the sum of the treatment effects equals zero. We've seen that since every, you know, for every announced variance model. Right? I don't know what I'm doing this for. I am the whitest man in the world, first of all. Okay. The block effects, okay, the effect of the block, are normal. They're independent of each other. They have a mean of zero and a variance of sigma squared sub pi. We just have to give it a name.
All that means is, so within one block, which will say the non-francophone, non-learning anything in French class for 12 years block, that the effect of being in that block is normally distributed with a mean of zero. The effect of being in the other block, let's say the one that of the people that are perfectly bilingual, has a mean of zero. It's independent of the other block effect. And it's normally distributed. This isn't surprising. This is the kind of thing you've seen before. And because it's really, in a lot of respects, it's a random variable, and random variables should be like that. And error is also going to be, of course, as usual, normally distributed independent with a mean of zero and a variance of sigma squared sub epsilon. So these aren't assumptions that are anything surprising. In fact, if you look at the assumptions in plain old vanilla analysis of variance, the only thing we don't have is the pi one. These two are the same. Okay? Error, epsilon, is independent of pi, because there's nothing there saying that they depend on each other. So they must be independent of pi. So epsilon is independent of pi. There is no term in the model that says epsilon times pi. Right? There is no term in the model that says tau times pi. There can't be any interactions here. So there's no interactions at all. So there's not also any tau by pi interactions. Remember, it made sense when we had the same people, but we can't really say that now with different people, even though we have homogeneous external units. Excuse me. So now we have this. This is just saying, if you think with the model, that just falls out of the model, those two. That there is no interaction there anywhere, because the model is x equals mu plus tau plus pi plus epsilon. There is nothing in there saying tau times pi or pi times epsilon or tau times epsilon times pi or any other combination of the above. So you can't be any interactions. What happens if there is an interaction? I mean, it's just because we say there can't be one doesn't mean there isn't going to be one. No. Well, there's only one place we can get an increase, and it's at epsilon. Right? Think about the model. Again, here's the model. It can't go to mu, because mu is not even it doesn't vary. We already have the treatment effect and the block effect. There's only one place it can go, and that's the error. So all this is going to do, if there is an interaction, is it's going to make the error term bigger. So if error gets bigger, you lose power. So can you violate this assumption? Go nuts. But if you do, and you don't find an effect, it may be because you've lost power. It may not be because there actually isn't an effect. Right. So basically, my advice to you is, if you're using one of these models, don't have any interactions. Hey doc, it hurts when I do this. Well, then don't do that. That's basically what I'm saying here, right? Just don't do this and you're fine. Problem is, how do you know? You can't know in advance. And there's no... Are we going to get a mean squared for any interaction? Well, there's no thing in the model for interactions. How can we even measure this? We'd have to actually look at the data themselves. Okay? So what we have here is the kind of thing I was talking about, different language learning methods and different experience with a language, low, medium, and high. Okay? I learned something new. Worked here since 1996. I probably learned something.
Okay.
So, in this case, and I don't even know how we're measuring it. I don't know what the three methods are. I don't know which one is the straight lecturing, which one's the. I don't really care either. But you can see how there's perhaps a problem here. Let's go back. There's a potential problem here because
Is there any interaction there between block and treatment method, teaching method? There probably is. The lines are parallel. Right? Exploratory data analysis. You look at the graph. Can we measure it? No, it's impossible. We cannot measure the interaction. So we know, in fact, that if we don't find an effect here, it may be because we violated the assumption of independence, of interactions. Now, how do we... In this case, we're probably okay. We don't have any disorderly interactions, no lines crossing. We seem to have a pretty clear case that most of the time, method 3 is the best and method 2 than method 1. We're probably pretty safe to say that method 3 is better than both methods 2 and 1. You know, we're going to find something. The problem is if we don't find something, we can just look at this and go, and it could be because there's an interaction. So you have to be very careful with these kind of designs. You have to look at it and say, is it okay? Does this make sense? Is there a big interaction there? If it's too big, there are ways to deal with this, which we'll talk about eventually. But usually you don't have the resources, right? Okay. You know, you could actually have more than one repeated measures variable. You could test the same people on two kinds of tests, implicit and explicit memory. You could test them in 5 minutes, 1 hour, and 24 hours. And it's all the same people. So G1. They're all group one. They're all the same people. You know, implicit memory, so that's, let's say, word fragment completion. And the explicit test will be, I don't know, recall. Again, this is not that interesting an experiment. Don't think, ooh, there's my honors thesis. This has been tried. Innumerable times. You get a good result, but no one can care. Okay, that's going to put up with two push pins. It's going to frame me. You know, it's funny. People listen to this thing for reasons that escape me. All over the world, people listen to our class. Right? 1.3 million people have downloaded, well, 1.3 million downloads of my podcast and lectures. 4.5 years. Which, you know, I don't understand why. But the number of times these people must think, what the hell is he doing? You know? Like, I just... For those of you scoring at home, I just picked the poster, it bothered me, and I did a thing with it. That should explain it all. Okay. Moving right along. Do you see the design here? Does this make sense? We just same people tested them 6 times. Okay, so 5 minutes, 1 hour, 24 hours. Those are retention intervals. And two kinds of memory tests, implicit and explicit. All right. What's the model here? Wow, x equals mu plus alpha plus beta plus alpha beta plus pi. Plus alpha pi plus beta pi plus alpha beta pi. Does that sound strangely like a Dr. Seuss poem? Walk it in my pocket. And a toothbrush on my toothbrush. The course of the chair is everywhere. It's like people are trying to mess with me. Last ones where I actually threw a chair into a hall because it was pissing me off so much. I kept walking into it. I can't see. I walk into crap all the time. So I want to make it less likely. And you know me, I can't actually stand still. Every report card I ever got, David is quite fidgety. And tends to take over group work. You'd never guess that, would you? I've been described as having a big personality, which it seems to me is a kind of backhanded way of saying, well, I'm an overbearing asshole. Not in my report cards. They just directly said, David's an overbearing asshole. But I'm kidding! All right. So there's our model. It's got two independent variables registered into it and people. It's a lot of terms here, right? I mean, and there's a lot of potential error terms. Remember, we're always using something that has, unless we have something that says epsilon, which we don't here, we use something with pi in it, something with a subject factor in it. That's what we divide by, because of the expected values of the mean squares. How do we know what to test with what? In other words, what do we divide, say, sum of squares for, or sorry, mean squared for A by? What do we divide mean squared for B by? Well, right here, it's going to look like this. I'm assuming N equals 10, by the way. There's 10 subjects in the experiment. And that means there's 59 total degrees of freedom, so 60 subjects. What I've done here is I've listed, the first thing I've done when I've constructed this, and there's a method to the way I'm doing this, is I've listed subjects first. So the subjects factor, and it has n minus 1 degrees of freedom, so it has 9 degrees of freedom. We're not going to test the subject factor. We don't care. We know that subjects are different from each other. Now I'm going to list retention interval. It didn't matter which one I picked. I picked retention interval because I felt like it. It's going to have 2 degrees of freedom because there's 3 levels, right? 5 minutes, 1 hour, 24 hours. And then what I did, how did I get this next subject by retention interval? I said retention interval, what's above it? By subjects. Got it. And that's going to have n minus 1 times levels of retention interval minus 1. 18 degrees of freedom. Now if I take a look here at the retention interval, what below this has retention interval and its subject as as a term? Oh, right below it there's this. That means when I eventually do my analysis of variance, I'm going to test mean squared retention interval by dividing it by mean squared for subjects by retention interval, just like we did with the regular sort of one-way repeated measures. I got another term to deal with, though, another factor. That's memory test type. We're calling M. There's two kinds. There's an explicit test and an implicit test. That's got 2 degrees of freedom, or sorry, 1 degree of freedom, 2 minus 1, is 1. And then what do I do? M by S, M by RI, M by S by RI. How do I know what to test memory with? Well, I just gave you a rule. Find the thing that has M in it and subjects just below it until you go, oh, right here. What do I test for the interaction of memory test type by retention interval? I just go below it and find the one that has these two in it and retention interval right there. So the way you do this is you list the subjects first, and then you start listing terms, and you always cross them with everything above them. So again, I listed subjects, then retention interval, then retention by subjects. Got it. Memory. Memory by subjects. Memory by subjects by retention. Sorry, memory by retention interval. Memory by subjects by retention interval. Okay? And there's a nice way to check if you've done this right. If you've calculated degrees of freedom right, they should add up to the total number of degrees of freedom in the design, which in this case is 59, because there's 60 observations. Did that make sense, what I just did there? Yeah, oh, please tell me, yes.
How is memory 1?
Because there's 2 kinds of memory.
Oh.
And plus next. Right, so memory has 2 levels, 2 minus 1 is 9. Doing this thing, what that's called is Gates order. We haven't learned all of how to do Gates order yet. There's a whole other thing we're going to bring in. Next one. So, I'm going to leave you with a cliffhanger. So next time, you're going to see that what you end up doing is you do between subject factors, then the subjects, then the within subject factors. But right now, we haven't talked about using between subject factors. But by doing this, it's very mechanical, and you can learn how to figure out error terms for designs that you couldn't even imagine. There's another way to do it, of course. The other way would be to actually work out the expected values of the mean squares for every term in your model. In the words of Seinfeld, good luck with all that kind. No one does that. Because the Ferengi apes came up with, somehow magically this works. And it always works. As long as everything's a fixed factor and subjects are considered a random factor. Now, if you do have one of these weird occasions, and none of you will until you're in graduate school, and you'll still go below, but if you get to one of these cases where two of these are random, three of them are fixed, and you can't figure out what the error terms are, a good graduate-level statistics book at the back has a way to calculate expected mean squares. And then you can just work through it. It's very mechanical. The other way to do it is go find someone in a statistics department and say, I don't know how to analyze my data. I'll give you $100. That also works. Right? Or typically in your department, if you're in grad school, there's some, usually graduate students, a stats whiz who you go to. But using that system, that Yates order, it's beautiful, it's simple as hell. And we're going to do so many freaking examples of it. Working out what the degrees of freedom are, the source of variation, and the error terms. That this is going to become something that is going to be almost... You'll be able to do it almost in your sleep. And about half the final exam is doing those things. We do lots of... Okay? Question about the stuff? Remember the assignments? There, yeah, sorry.
Not about the stuff, but for that software for me doing Amy, when are
you? Yeah, next Wednesday.
Next Wednesday?
Yeah, it's set up. Amy's going to do it all. She seems fine now. So it'll be next Wednesday, free period, 11:30. And I'll let you know when, what computer lab it's going to be in.
Okay.
But yeah, and I'll be announcing that. There'll be something on the blog and all that.
Okay.
All right, thanks, guys.
Released under a Creative Commons copyright, Sharealike 2.5 Canada. Feel free to redistribute the information as you see fit, but please don't make any money out of it. And if you do, you got to tell me because I'm reserving that right. Giving up all the other ones, including mash it up any way you want, okay? Also, of course, give me attribution. If you want to get a hold of me, my email address is dave.brodbeck, B-R-O-D-B-E-C-K, at algomau.ca. My website is people.auc.ca/broadbeck/blog. Most of the music, all the music's PodSafe, and most of it comes from GarageBand.com or the PodSafe Music Network. See you next time.